gonna, and we don't have much time, we're gonna get a little bit intellectually heavy. So try to stay with me. If I see more than four people falling asleep, we'll take a break and we'll shake it out a little bit. If two of you are falling asleep, I hope everyone else will just catch them up as we go through. But I taught at the U of A yesterday, and there was a guy the whole time with his earphones in and his eyes closed. And I was like, wow, I could not get away with that in school, you know. But it was a little disconcerting. I just had to not focus on him so much. But so what I want to do tonight is give you some shared language to talk about, you know, that we can jump off from. So I want to give you some Buddhist concepts, and they're not easy concepts. In fact, they're quite difficult. They're not difficult intellectually, but they're going to invert the whole way you think about the world. And the professor, I just spoke in a class called Jesus in Contemporary Thought at the U of A yesterday. An amazing teacher, Karen Bork, really an incredible scholar. Some of you may know her. Just a great scholar, and she gave me some readings to read before the class. And I was reading them, and I felt uneasy as I was reading them. It was a man that wrote a book called Without the Buddha, I Couldn't Be a Christian. And it was his coming to terms with Buddhism and Christianity. It's a beautiful book, but I couldn't figure out why I was uneasy. Because the book is, you know, I admire the author. And he's got a good mind. He's got a very strong heart. I was like, why am I uneasy with this reading? And then I realized that the groundwork of the whole reading was a basic assumption. And I realized that it's an assumption you see in much of academia. And it's an assumption that can be drastically limiting. And it's an assumption that's so subtle that most of the time I never even notice it. And if I can try to express what that was, it was that mostly as we read about religion, as we try to understand religion, or as we read about religious experience, we think, how can I make sense of this religious idea using my basic perceptual models? Right? Like, I mean, let's take an example of Jesus walking on water. We say, okay, how, using what I know about the world, how can I understand Jesus walking on water? Maybe it's a myth. Maybe it's real. If it's real, how can I make sense of that? You know, so how can I make sense of the virgin birth? You know, how can I use my basic perceptual models, how I understand reality? How can I use those ideas to then understand religious ideas? And suddenly it occurred to me as I was reading yesterday that what if you inverted that whole question and said, rather, how do I have to shift my perceptual models so that I can understand reality clearer? You see, it's a very subtle shift. I'm not saying how can I use what I know about the world to understand religion. I'm saying the ways that I know the world, how is it limiting my ability to experience truth? And that's a tricky thing, because what I'm basically saying in that statement is, try to think about something you've never thought of before. Right? And like, somebody throw out an object, any object.
Pizza.
Somebody throw out another object.
A hat.
All right, let's imagine pizza in the shape of a hat. Okay, we've all just imagined something we've never thought of before. That's not what I mean. I mean a whole nother intellectual model. How can we imagine a whole nother like intellectual model, a whole nother perceptual mode that we've never thought of before? And in a sense, I think this is what religion forces us to do. There's a Zen story, and many of you know of it, but it's the teachers pointing at the moon. The moon in Zen stories it's called twilight language. There's these symbols used throughout religious stories that represent things. And the moon represents the enlightened state, the state of mind that has directly perceived reality. And the teacher's pointing at the moon, right? And all of the students are staring at the hand. And they're analyzing the hand. And that's what academia is, mostly in terms of the study of religion. we're saying, isn't it fascinating how the middle finger curves right next to the, you know, the little finger, and there's a 90-degree angle, you know. And we can spend years talking about the hand when it's just a, it's trying to point us to an experience. It's trying to, and there's another thing that I saw in this book as I was reading. He kept saying that Jesus and Buddha are trying to show us what is. And from an Eastern perspective, that's 100% wrong. There's no spiritual teacher that is trying to show you what is. You hear in, from Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu that the Tao that can be spoken of is not the Tao. That's not so, it's not, that's not a abstract mystical idea. It just means that reality is not something that can be spoken of in a positive. We can't say this is what reality is. All we can do is say this is what reality is. Isn't, right? We can say this is how you're misperceiving it. So the Buddha, Jesus, can't tell you what reality is. They can't tell you what heaven is, what God is. They can just tell you this is how you're misperceiving it. This is what it isn't. And so I want to propose tonight that we to try to invert our thinking a little bit and try to I'm going to challenge some of maybe your ideas about the world. And just for the sake of potential evolution, I just want to invite us all to just try to suspend disbelief for a moment and try to imagine that, what the world would be like if some of these ideas were in fact correct. And what we're going to talk about tonight is we're going to talk about karma and emptiness. And those are the two most misunderstood terms in Buddhism, they're incredibly misunderstood in this culture. So I hope to give you a slightly less misunderstood version of that. But think about it in terms of that inversion of what, in the Hindu scriptures they say, many, many, not this, not that. And it's the same idea. It's that the Tao that can be spoken of is not the Tao. Anytime you think you have it or somebody's showing it to you, you're wrong, only in that it's not something that can be shown to you. It's the absence of something that you thought was there that's not there. Okay? I know it's abstract, and I hope it'll get less abstract. let me give you an example. When I moved to town, I'd moved here from Alabama, and I had all, you know, I closed my bank account in Alabama, and I took it all as cash, right? So I had about $4,000 or $5,000 of cash with me. And I was going to open a bank account at I don't even remember my bank. But down on Stone and Congress, you know, across from the public library down there. And so I was going to go open a bank account and put all this cash in the bank account. And before I did that, I needed to go return the library book at this little library up by River and Craycroft. Yeah. Anybody know that little library? So anyway, I walk into the library, and I didn't want to leave all this cash in the car, so I brought it in with me. I returned a book, and then I saw some magazines that looked interesting, so I was like, let me just see what's going on in the world, and I sit down and read for a minute. Then I get up, get back in the car, and then I drive all the way down to Stone and Congress, right? And I opened up the back door to get the briefcase, and what do you think I found? An absence of the briefcase, right? I had left it in the library, so there was about $4,500 of cash sitting in by the magazines at the library. That experience of opening up the back door and realizing something isn't there that you thought was there, that is the religious experience that I want to talk about tonight. That is why Jesus or the Buddha can't show it to you. What they can show you is something that's not there that you thought was there. So I want to be bold enough to say that all of us are drastically misperceiving reality. We simply are not perceiving reality correctly. We are in a kind of a daze, a confused daze. Now, this sounds hard to imagine. To me, it sounds hard to imagine. And do you remember when you were 16, you thought you knew it all? Right? And the only reason I know this is because I'm at that same stage right now where I feel like I know it all. And I just taught in Detroit with two women in their 60s, you know, and we were debriefing at the end. We debrief our talks, you know, to see how we can learn and how we what we learn from each other. So we're debriefing it. one woman said, I really enjoy teaching with you, Will, because you have a younger perspective and this kind of stuff. And then she turned to the other lady and she said, and I really like teaching with you because we've had shared life experience that somebody younger doesn't have, you know. And I really thought, well, actually, I probably have the same life experience as you, right? Now, these are two women that have children, grandchildren, careers, retirement, right? All this stuff that I don't have. But I honestly can tell you that I felt like I had as much wisdom and life experience as them. You know? And I felt the incongruency. I'm like, but it doesn't seem like I would. And then I remembered when I was 16, I felt like I had the same knowledge that a 39-year-old would have. But I can tell you with certainty that I can look at a 16-year-old and be like, you don't know everything yet, you know? I promise you I know stuff that you don't know. And it's not ideas. It's an emotional maturity that I didn't have at 16, you know? So what I mean to say is it's so hard for us to imagine that we are limited in our capacity, that we are not at the end of our evolution. You know, is anybody in that same boat? It's so hard for me to imagine that I'm not, it's some, like, close to the end of my evolution in terms of my ability to understand things. I'm not talking about, like, understanding computer programs and stuff, but I'm talking about, like, some kind of subtle, like, I have this sense that I'm at some kind of subtle level of maturation. So what I want to invite us to do tonight is to admit, maybe for a moment, that we are still in a state of misperception. That we are not at the final stage of our evolution. And that Jesus has invited us, as many of the spiritual masters has been, there's an invitation open to us to evolve, to grow. Now, if I said to you, who here would like to know truth? Who here would like to know reality? Most of us would... Hi, come on in. It's my own mother's late. if I said to you, oh man, you guys have to see this.
Sorry, we got lost.
If I said to you, who here would like to experience reality? I mean, most of us, I don't think there's many people that say, I'd rather not experience it. If I said to you, who would rather have a more accurate, inclusive view of reality than you have now? Very few of us would say, I would rather not. You know, most of us would say, yes, I would like to experience a greater truth. But now what if I rephrased that and said, who here would like all of their misperceptions ripped out from them? You know? Who here would, you know, basically, who here would like to go through adult puberty? Like, if I could suddenly force adult puberty on you, where you're having to reform your whole view of the world again and again, and there's no solid ground. You know, most of us are like, maybe after Jeopardy. You know, like, maybe not right now, but maybe tomorrow let's talk, or I'll call you and we'll get our calendar set up. So, the evolution, what I mean to say is evolution is painful. Growth is painful. Growth has a kind of suffering in it, a kind of inherent suffering, because you are forced to reevaluate your perception of reality. I'll tell a story that some of you have heard. I was driving across Texas and I saw a UFO. And so there I am driving, and those of you that have driven across Texas, you know it goes on and on, right? It's like, you know, like 7 days later, you're like, oh, but so I'm driving on and on, and there's a UFO, and people were, and you know, so I'm going through, okay, is it a weather balloon, was my first thought. Is it a helicopter? Is it some weird airplane? You know, and I'm eliminating all of these possibilities. And then people are starting to pull over on the side of the road to get a better look at it, and then I'm like, should I pull over, or like, you know, I didn't have a cell phone, but I was like, you know, should I try to find a payphone or, like, call the police? Or, you know, all these things going through my mind. What do you think my emotional experience was? What would you say? Tell me.
Exciting.
What else?
Fear.
Yeah, what else?
Curiosity.
Disbelief. None of those I experienced. I had one emotional experience. I was pissed off. And I was so surprised by that. It's like, why am I so irritable about this? And so I stopped looking at it. I'm I'm like, I'm just not going to look at it. I'm just going to drive. I turn on the radio, you know, and I'm just driving. And then, you know, like 5-10 minutes later, I'm like this, right? And it's still there. I'm like, damn it. I'm just getting, like, I'm getting mad. And the reason it stuck in my head so much is because it was such an unlikely reaction to seeing the UFO. To just get mad, right? I'm just mad. Why do you think I was mad?
You don't believe in UFOs.
Well, because I don't believe in UFOs. Why else?
You didn't have someone in the car to talk to.
Well, yeah, I couldn't talk to. But it also created what they call in the performing arts a dilated mind. It forced me to be in a state of dis-ease, right? Because I was being forced, my perceptual models were being forced to encompass something I couldn't encompass, right? I remember one time I was hitchhiking through South Dakota and I got picked up by a buckwheat farmer in a big 18-wheeler, and we're driving along and we see a big sign for a dinosaur museum. And he says to me, he's kind of a born-again, he says to me, oh, I prefer not to believe in those. And I was like, I didn't know we had a choice. Right? I didn't know that was an option. I wish somebody had told me I did not believe in dinosaurs. And suddenly I had a weird thought come to me. What if, like, God put a dinosaur museum close to him? You know what I mean? To jolt him, you know? In a sense, it's like our belief systems limit our ability to experience the divine. And that's really what I'm trying to say, is our belief systems limit our experience to perceive the divine. But yet, we hold on to them with such passion. Because when we are forced to let go of our belief systems, there's an extreme dis-ease that comes into the body. There's an extreme uncomfortableness that comes into the body. It's why, especially in this culture, we don't like to talk about death. We don't ever see death. I never saw a dead body until I went to India. And then I saw them like every day. You know, I would swim in the Ganga and an arm would float down. Literally, this happened to me, you know. I would see a body like seaweed that had been stuck in the mud. You know, there's death all around you. When I went to see my teacher, I had to walk through the burning grounds, you know. And if you imagine what a burning ground would be in America, this is where you burn bodies. It would be such a morbid, intense place, you know. But in India, kids are playing marbles and flying kites. The relatives are like drinking chai and laughing and telling stories. And there's always one grandmother who's sobbing. And, you know, people aren't running to her to like comfort her. It's just every emotion is allowed in the face of death. You know? But for us, the idea of death is so uncomfortable. It creates such a sense of fear that we prefer not to look at it, right? It creates a dilated state. We approach it with a kind of anger sometimes. So, again, I want to suggest that that there is a view of reality that we can't even comprehend, and I want to start to begin to chisel away at how we're misperceiving things. I want to start to chisel away at how we're misperceiving things. You know, when I think for me, I started having this breakdown in my Christian faith when I got into notions of like heaven and eternity, right? Because I started thinking about, like, as much as I love my family and my friends, do I really want to be in eternity with them? You know? It's like. And I know I can say this with my mother because I know she probably doesn't want to be in eternity with me. You know, I get grumpy and I need alone time and, you know. I was getting this notion of like this vampiric eternity, you know, where everyone's like, hi, Grandma. You know, and it just doesn't end. And try to come back to what I said at the beginning. Why? Because I'm taking my perceptual models and trying to fit them onto religious experience. Do you see what I'm saying? I'm taking a basic perceptual model of how I know the world works, and I'm trying to overlay it on religious experience of heaven in this example. I'm taking what I know about time, about subject and object. I'm taking what I know about relationship, and I'm talking, and then I try to overlay it onto this notion of heaven. And that notion is this body doesn't die, and I'm around the same personalities. You know, this I'm talking about a kind of innocent view of heaven. And so I started thinking that, you know, that model, it sounds unpleasant, like, and it also just doesn't. It didn't resonate. There's nothing real about that resonated with me. One of the ways we exist that we don't even know, right? It's like how they say, you know, a fish doesn't know about water. There's a beautiful quote from, most of you know Rumi, who is, interestingly enough, the most read poet in America, right? And he's, what century is Rumi? I want to say 7th or something. Maybe earlier, later.
6th.
Anyways, a 6th century Muslim poet, right? And he's the most read poet in America. But he has a beautiful quote, and it says, God is the look in your eye that's looking for God. So close to us that we can't even see it. Do you ever have that experience, you wake up from a dream, and you're so close to it, you can't remember it?
Yeah.
And then, like, later in the day, you're like, oh, you know? When things get so close to us, we become completely oblivious to them. One of those things that we're so close to is what is subject-object relationships. We experience the world only through subject and object. I'm not going to get into a lot. It's a rather confusing topic, but there's me, subject, will, experiencing you, object, people. You know, there's always a triangulation. You know, I'm always bouncing things off, which is how I know reality. And also, time can only exist in a subject-object relationship. There's two things. You have to have two things to have time. You know, you have to have before and after. There's a whole notion of subject and object. I want to suggest that there's a type of heaven that doesn't exist in subject-object time reality. And there's a path to get there in the Buddhist tradition that's very interesting that I want to go into a little bit. In order for us to talk about it, we have to talk about emptiness. And emptiness is a confusing but very beautiful idea. And when I say emptiness from a Buddhist standpoint, who is here? You had some lectures on Buddhism here before, didn't you?
Back in Paul.
Yeah. Who did the word emptiness come up at all? That anybody remembers? When I say emptiness, what do you think of? Just throw out words or sentences. Nothing. Yeah, what else?
Loss.
All gone.
What did you say?
Loss.
Loss. All gone. What else?
Peace.
Peace. Yeah, what else?
Vacuum.
Dark. What did you say?
Vacuum.
Vacuum, yeah. It sounds so elusive, you know? It's like, you have this wrong idea in Buddhism, like meditate on emptiness means just like emptying the mind. You know, meditation, which we'll end tonight talking about a little bit, is not about emptying the mind. The Buddhists say that there's no such thing as emptying the mind. There's a joke in Tibet that even, there's an idea that meditation is about like just chilling out. And just like being in this zone of like, kind of like, you know, and the Tibetans say that even rabbits can do that. that's not what meditation is. My father gave me a birthday card one time, and it had a picture of a yoga class, you know, like a cartoon picture. And everyone was sitting in meditation posture, and the teacher says, okay, now everybody empty your mind. And everybody had these little bubbles above their heads, you know, and the bubbles were all empty, except one person had a cupcake in their bubble. And then you open the card and it says, the newcomer. That is completely wrong. Okay? There's no such thing as an empty bubble. Meditation is simply the ability to keep the mind focused on and off. There's always an object of meditation, and there's always a subject of meditation. So I just want to nip that in the bud right at the get-go. There's no such thing as emptying the mind. There's no such thing as nothingness in the way that we think of there's no such thing as spacing out or just think about black. Or, so what is emptiness? What is this right here?
Desk.
A desk or a podium, right? To a termite, what would it be?
Lunch,
right? It would be 100% sustenance. So what is it really?
It's an object.
It's an object. Who's right, the termite or me?
Yes.
Right. You have to say it depends, right? You have to say it depends on who's perceiving it. Are you telling me that that is not, you know, this is not food from its own side, right? This does not have food. This does not have foodness in it.
Not to you.
Not to me, right? Now, here's. I was trying to set you up, trying to get your minds ready to grasp something that we never think about, right? And this is it. When I walk into this room, right, I have an idea that you all are here and you exist out there, right? The light comes. Oh.
Yeah.
When he just walked into the room, right? We all existed here. The light comes off of us, and then it goes into his cones, right, and his rods and his eye. Those get processed in the brain, and he makes sense of what he sees. We have that notion that the world exists like that. I walk into the room, and then. You guys are out there, and the movement is there to hear. Okay? Everybody get a sense of that movement. The movement is that you're out there, and you come towards me. Okay? The whole punchline to all of Buddhism is that it's the other way around. That the whole world is being projected from me. That there is no you there, until I walk in and I project you in front of me. Now, this sounds abstract, and it is abstract. And we're going to try to make it a little simpler. So in the same way that we can't say that that is a podium or food from its own side. We have to say it depends on who is perceived, right? Because certainly for a termite, this functions purely as food, right? If I tried to eat it, it would probably kill me, right? No matter how hard a termite tries, it cannot perceive that as a podium. Right? So we have to at least say that this exists as both a podium and as food. Can we agree on that? So we have to say that there is no podiumness from its own side. If it existed as a podium from its own side, it would come at us like this, right? Its podiumness would be inherent in this as an object. Or its foodness would be inherent in it as an object. But it's not. It's the mind stream that's engaging it that puts the label podium or food onto it. So, I mean, certainly we can say there's an object here. Certainly we can say there's some kind of matter here. But what that matter is, we have to say that's coming from us. Come on in, guys. What this is, we have to, right? Can we be on that same page? We have to say that what this is coming from us. Another way we can say it is we can almost say that realness is multiple. Okay? Realness is multiple. Now, you know, normally I think, well, what is it really? Is it really food for a termite, or is it really a podium? Now, when I said to you, when I walked in here, and I'm projecting you, the movement is going this way. It's not you are there, and then you're coming into my perceptual field. I'm actually projecting you, it's coming out this way. The Buddhists say from the Meshikbe Tigle, which is a funny name for this, what they call the indestructible drop. This little drop that lives in the area of the heart that is indestructible. Meaning that if an atom bomb was set off right here in this room, our bodies would immediately be vaporized, but this indestructible drop would not be affected at all. So it's a kind of we'll just say it's an indestructible drop.
Is that your soul?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, you could almost say that that's what you could almost say that it's something like a soul. It's a big debate.
So all the souls are called out there in front.
Yeah, now we're getting inaccurate, and it gets hard to talk about it because there's a lot of foundational language that we would need first to talk about it. But just for our discussion, I want to suggest that the world is being projected out from that spot. Which means that, again, just try to hold on to this idea that realness is multiple. That realness is multiple. So why is it that, let's take the example of somebody. Everybody think of somebody that you really like. Okay, just put a vision of them in your mind. Now, think of somebody else that doesn't like that person. Most of us can find that, right? It's hard to find somebody that everybody likes. Even like Desmond Tutu, even like the Dalai Lama, there's people that really dislike those people, you know? So is the goodness coming from that person? Now, reverse it. Think of somebody that you really dislike, okay? Can we say that they are dislikable from their own side? Their unlikability is coming from them towards you. Or do we have to say that it's coming from you towards them? They're like a blank screen that you're overlaying unlikability onto. How do we know this? We can prove this through a number of ways. We can prove this, one, because there's somebody that likes them. Tibetan Buddhism gets heavy into syllogisms and logics, and we debate a lot, you know? And one of the proofs of something existing self-existently is every mind stream has to see it that way. For example, if somebody is annoying from their own side, when they come out of the womb, the mother sees the child and says, "What an annoying child." And the aunts and uncles are like, "Oh, it's so annoying." So annoyingness does not come from the being, right? Annoyingness does not come from your boss, right, or your neighbor. And another proof we have of this is we've all had an experience of somebody in our lives that we dislike, that then we suddenly shift and start to like. I had this happen with Amanda one time. There was a guy that I really disliked, and she came out to visit us, and she's like, "I love that guy." I'm like, "You like that guy?" So here's what happens in my mind. I'm like, she just came out, she's just meeting him, she doesn't really know him. You know what I mean? Like, again, I have such a strong belief in the realness of something. I have such a strong belief that realness is not multiple. That there is a realness, she doesn't see it, and I see it. Right? Give it time, Amanda, he's really annoying. But what happened for me is I suddenly started to see what she saw that I couldn't see before. And within 3 days, I loved the guy. I was like, "This guy, why?" Like, I couldn't even see what I used to see. Another example is I used to work with high-functioning autistic children in Alabama. And they had a school system where they put all of the weird kids in one school system. And so that's the school system I worked in. I remember my first day on the job, I walked in, and it was like the most insane scene. There was all this like physical deformities, and there was screaming, and there's just like this cafeteria about four times the size of this filled with the weirdest looking and acting children you've ever seen. And I walk in, I felt like, I'm home, you know? It was like this incredible homecoming. But I remember I came to this one kid, Tyler, and he was sitting at the table, and he had some physical deformities where his head was huge. I mean, it was bizarrely huge. It was like, you know, something like this. And he had all these braces that had to hold his head up. And I thought he was terrifying looking. Like, absolutely disgusting. You know, it was like really disturbing to look at. Incredible deformities in the face and stuff. And I don't say this to show that I'm a good person or anything, but by the time I left there, I could not see the ugliness that I saw on the first day. And it wasn't out of some like open heart, kind-heartedness or anything. I physically couldn't see it. And I remember one of my last days, I was staring at him and I was trying to see the deformities. And I was having a really hard time seeing how he was different. It was so jarring to me because it was such a physical quality, you know? I was like, he doesn't look that different. You know, I mean, the head's a little bit different, but it wasn't that like, you know, like, wow, that's so weird. So there is this notion that we have this belief that annoyingness exists outside of us. We really do, you know. We live our lives in this way. Again, it's an inversion. It's a kind of evolution that we can't even conceive of. Like we're like these 16-year-olds that think like we got it all down, you know. And there's somebody else. There are these other great beings that are telling us, no, there's a whole. There's more, right? There's more evolution. And you're like, yeah, yeah, I'm sure there is. You know. That's how I engage these teachers. Just that feeling of like, yeah, and again, it's because I'm trying to overlay my perceptual models onto something as opposed to figure out how my perceptual models are wrong, right? Like, it's a very subtle shift. So, when they say emptiness, all they mean, the only thing that's meant by that is that this podium is not a podium from its own side. Now, does that mean, right, so we have to say this podium is empty of podiumness. Because the only way it's a podium is because I'm projecting podium onto it. If there's only termites in this room and there's no human beings, what is this in this room? We have to say it's food, but when you really look at the mind, you say, well, it's a podium that termites are eating. You know, often we think about that. I mean, we think that way. If there's no termites in this room and there's just the human mind streams, we have to say it's a podium. So from its own side, there is nothing here. There is no self-existent thing here. We can say there's a thing here. We can say there's molecules and atoms and things like that. But we can't say that there's... And just to quickly fast-track you, even that can be analyzed a little bit further, but we're not going to go there. So we can say that there's some kind of molecules and things, but it doesn't have a ness, N-E-S-S. I studied with this great Tibetan Buddhist master, old school Tibetan Buddhist guys, you know, and where they tell you for 9.5 days how precious human beings are over and over and over, and then if you last that long, they give you one little teaching on emptiness, you know. Most people like leave frustrated. You're like, what is this guy saying? Like get to the point, you know. But I managed to survive one of those teachings. End, he said, just you have to be suspicious of all the N-E-S-S at the end of everything. There is no essential nature to anything. There's no podiumness. So when we talk about emptiness, that's what we're talking about. Now, well, first of all, does anybody have any basic problems with that?
I always have trouble like applying that to the self.
Yeah, right.
I can get it on the podium,
yeah.
But I don't get it when I can't transfer that.
I remember hanging up long with my girlfriend one time, and I was looking at her, you know, and I just read this teaching that the partner that you go to bed with is not the same partner you wake up with. That there is no personness there. There is no substantial character. There is no inherent characteristic of another person. There's just a movement. There's a constant movement of personality. But I was realizing, I was just watching, I was watching her hang laundry, I realized that there was that the way I saw her was always changing. Right? There was going to be an end to my perception of her as being my partner. I just felt the end of that. You know, I felt the Buddha say that everything is changing. All is change. And it's a bigger topic. Like, how do you apply this idea of emptiness to the self? But one way, the easier to access it, is how you can apply it to other people. And realize that there is, that your partner is not an NESS. You know? Like, there is no Chuckness. there is a phenomenon that we label shock that is always changing. So I tell you one of the problems that comes up for me with this idea. Another way to think about it is a pen, right? We can all say this is a pen. If I were to shake it in front of a dog, what would it be? A chew toy, right? So we can say that the pen doesn't exist as a pen from its own side. Because for a dog, it is a chew toy. For us, it is a pen. So here's one of the problems that should arise over time. So then what we're saying is the existence of this as a pen is coming from my mind. That's what I'm proposing. It's coming from my mind, right? The existence of that person as being annoying or kind is coming from my mind. So doesn't that sound like just the power of positive thinking? Shouldn't I then be able to just decide not to dislike that person? And can we do that? In the same way, can I just decide that this isn't a pen? You know? Can I decide that this is a roll of $100 bills? Because in a sense, what I'm saying is that there is no pen here. I am proposing that there is no pen here in the way that you thought there was a pen. There is a changing phenomenon which you could see in something totally different. I'm suggesting that it would be possible to see this as a shaft of light, a pure light, and not as a pen. So can I just change how I see something? Can I just, when somebody's really annoying to me, can I just say, you know what, I'm going to be loving towards this person and not experience them as annoying? I try it all the time, right? And it lasts maybe like 3 minutes. And it's like, it's this effort of like, okay, their mother loves them, and, you know, I'm sure that somebody else loves them, and I'm going to try to open up and love them now, you know? And then they just keep pushing your buttons, and you're like, okay, I'm just leaving the room. So can I just decide to see this as food, right? And they say reality is being forced. You are being forced to perceive things a certain way. You're being forced to perceive things a certain way. So why do I experience somebody as annoying when somebody else experiences something as pleasant? Okay, so again, here's the thing is I cannot prove karma emptiness to you in such a short time. But I want to just imagine what life would look like if you adopted some of these ideas. Just play with what it would look like if you adopted some of these ideas. Why does that person, do I experience that person as annoying? We say it's because of seeds you planted in the past. Okay? It's because of seeds you planted in the past. I like to reverse engineer stuff. Like, to me, it's just a fascinating way of going about spiritual traditions. And I like to reverse engineer things in a negative context. So, okay, say I'm having a good relationship. And say that the goodness of that relationship is coming from, I'm proposing it's coming from seeds that I've planted. I'm proposing that this pen is coming from seeds I planted. In a highly, highly oversimplistic way, I'm able to experience this as a pen because I've helped other people communicate things in the past. Therefore, I planted seeds for me to experience this as a pen. I've helped people with learning, with communication, and I planted those seeds. From a Buddhist perspective, we've had past lives. So those seeds might have come from a past life. They might have come, you know, even in this life. And I'm also saying it's very possible for me to no longer be able to see this as a pen. Who is it? Jill Balte Taylor? Does anybody know that name? She's the, what is she?
Neuroscientist,
right? She had a stroke.
Oh, right.
And she talks about no longer being able to distinguish her hand from the rest of the molecules in the atmosphere, right? That she could no longer distinguish a pen from the thing that the pen was next to, right? I'm proposing that it's because of seeds I planted that I'm able to experience this as a pen. Now, can we say that she just was no longer able to see the pen because she had a stroke, right? We're saying that there is no pen-ness, okay? that she, her perception had just shifted with the same validity that a termite experiences out as food. Very hard to wrap the mind around. Incredibly difficult. So, yeah.
I don't want to throw this all off, but where does it come in that when we're small children, somebody says, this is a bit?
Yeah, and then you get into the whole sociological thing.
Okay.
Of like, you know, well, I was taught that this was a pen, and I was, you know, I went through days and days of learning how to hold it as a pen. And, you know, Buddhism, we do heavy debating in Buddhism. It's really fun. Nothing is sacred on the debate ground. It's such a great tradition for a religious organization, you know. You get on the debate ground, nothing is sacred, like, and you just debate it out. And you constantly ask, well, why was I experienced? Why was I born in a place where I was taught to experience this as a pen? And, you know, why do I have a mind that's capable of seeing this as a pen, and I'm not developmentally disabled, and I can't see it, you know? So, you know, you just keep going down and down and down. Why am I in a society? You know, we all share what we would say a collective karma to see this as a pen. We all have certain collective karmas. But... What was I saying right before that? No, it's all right.
About the scientist that lost her ability to differentiate.
Yeah, so just that. So I'm suggesting that I can lose the seeds to see this as a pen. So, oh, reverse engineering and partners.
Right.
So if I want to reverse engineer my good relationship and destroy it based on seeds, right? The way to do this is be dishonest with other people's partners. Right? Because the minute I'm dishonest with other people's partners, I'm planting seeds to have dishonesty come into my relationship. Or the minute I just find myself like it, how do they say it in the Ten Commandments? A covet thy neighbor's wife, right? The minute I covet thy neighbor's wife, I'm planting seeds to no longer be attracted to my own. Now, here's an interesting thing. You know, in the 60s, we had, like, all these gurus, right, with the Beatles and stuff, and everybody was like, oh, master, and like, oh, Ram, Sitaram, and there's all this prostration and stuff like that, right? We misunderstood what that was about. We just, because it was a new tradition coming into America, we had a kind of immaturity around it. The now you see is starting to mature. What would be a reason that I might show great reverence towards the spiritual? Throw out some ideas.
So does someone have great reverence to you?
Okay, so I'm planting the seeds that somebody might have great reverence to me. What else? What seeds am I planting
respect.
To show reverence, huh?
Respect.
Respect, yeah. I mean, in a sense, the reason I would show reverence to a spiritual teacher is so that I don't lose my vision of them as a wise being that can teach me. Because they're not wise from their own side. There is no wisdom that's exuding out from them. If I've said anything tonight that's of interest to you, it's not because I said anything of interest. It isn't. I am just, there's people here that have really probably haven't heard anything. I'm like, what is he talking about? Get to the point. When can we have snacks? And there's somebody else that's like has some new ideas, right? All I'm doing is I'm changing my vocal cord to create vibrations that are coming into your ear and vibrating your eardrum in a different way, right? It depends on what seeds you have that allow you, you know, those who have ears to hear. The language is there, the words are spoken, but some of us have ears to hear something. So I study with a spiritual teacher and I have a kind of, you know, this guru-disciple relationship. And a spiritual teacher is so much more elusive than a romantic partner. You all know how hard it is to keep a romantic partner, right? And to keep it fresh, to keep it new, to keep them of interest to you, you know? It's such a delicate juggle, right? Because it's always shifting. It's so elusive. A spiritual teacher is so much more elusive. So much more elusive. So the reason you bring an apple to your teacher, right, is not because they deserve it. It's not because they exude wisdom. It's not because they have a wisdomness, a wiseness, right? It's because you want to plant seeds to continue to see them as wise. It's a totally different way of thinking. You reap what you sow, you know? And so when I sit in, you know, I sit in front of my teacher, and I'd say 95% of the time, I'm thinking like, oh, this guy drives me crazy, you know? I mean, really, like, I struggle all the time. And then that 5% is so powerful that it keeps me going. You know, and think about your own relationship. How much percentage of the time when you think about your partner is it you being overwhelmed by how graceful they are? You know? Every time they talk, how much is it you thinking, like, God, they are amazing? You know? But yet still, we have some interest in them, you know? Because it's a weird balance, right? And with my spiritual teacher, it's the same way. It's so hard to keep that fresh. It's so hard to keep it new.
So what would be the analogy with your relationship partner in the same way as you have with your teacher?
So, well, yeah, and that's a beautiful thing. Is so there's a whole different reason to bring flowers to your partner. Because normally we bring flowers because we want them to love us, you know, and be like, oh, you love me. And, you know, I remember being in the airport and this couple was arguing. And she turned around, you know, he's behind her just kind of arguing. And she turned around, she's like, honey, you can be right or you can be happy. And that's your choice. So mostly, like, we think about bringing flowers to our partner so that we can be happy. You know what I mean? Mostly we bring flowers to our partner so we can be happy because it puts them in a good mood and then they don't bring us down, right? But if you use this idea of planting seeds, we bring flowers to our partner so that we continue to plant the seeds to see them as sacred, to see them as beautiful. Is everybody with me on the slight inversion of the thinking? So what we're talking about, all of Buddhism is about seed planting. It's just about what seeds do you want to plant to experience what things. Because there is no nest to anything. If you want to continue to see a podium in your life, I don't know what seeds you plant podium seeds, whatever they look like, you know? If you want to continue to see, if you want people to continue to like you, what seed would you have to plant?
Like others.
Yeah, not gossiping. Right? Divisive speech. What is divisive speech? Divisive speech is anytime I say something to you about somebody else to try to get you to think negatively about them. And we code it in all kinds of pleasant language. Bless their little heart, you know. They struggle. I know they're trying, but man, they are just so unintelligent. Right? Now, I'm putting an idea in your mind that that person is unintelligent, let's say. But what I'm really doing is I'm putting the seed in my heart to see people talking negatively about me. Now, are they really talking negatively about me? Is there a real nest to them talking negative? What do you think? I'm asking.
No, because there's no nest to anything.
Okay, but is there a realness to this? To this podium? Is there a realness to the podium?
From our projection.
We have to say it's real. If you don't think it's real, you know, I'll pick it up and I'll drop it on your toe, you know? And then the like illusory podium will crush your illusory toe, right? So we have to say the podium is real, it just has a multiple realness. And we can say it has a fluid realness. It is real, but it doesn't. It's not real in the way we thought it was real. It doesn't have a permanent realness. So, is it possible that somebody could say something negative about you? You hear somebody talking negatively about you, you know, like you overhear it in a room, right? And in that moment, that's real. You plant the seeds to experience it, that it's negative. What I'm saying is that the words that came out of their mouth are not negative from their own side. There is no reality to their words. Because you may have missed the first half of the sentence. You may have missed the second half. You may have missed the context altogether. You may think they're talking about you and they're not talking about you at all. Reality is fluctuating. Reality is always shifting. And it's always shifting based on what seeds are ripening. There's a beautiful story, it's also a story in the Sufi tradition, where a man was laying in a field one day, and it's a little unrealistic, but stay with me, and he accidentally swallowed a snake, a poisonous snake, while he was sleeping. He was sleeping with his mouth open, and this snake went into his mouth, right? And there was a wise man that saw this happen. The man thought, if I tell this guy he just swallowed a poisonous snake, he's going to panic, right? And it'll kill him. What I need to do is get him to throw it up.
So this man just started chasing him and beating him, you know, in the stomach. And just beating him and, like, you know, sticking his fingers at his throat. And this guy's like, you crazy, like, leave me alone, you know, help, help, I'm being beaten, right? So that man, in that moment, is having a perception of himself being beaten, right? It is real that he's being beaten, in the same way as this podium. It's real that he's being beaten in the negative sense, right? We have to say that there's a realness to that. Then later, when the snake finally comes out, he realizes that that man saved his life. So that there's an initial perception that this man is trying to kill him, and then a later perception that this man actually saved his life. Our whole life is love. You know? There is our whole past, they call it spiritual revisionism. Our whole past, we solidify it. That person was mean to me, that person was nice to me. You know? That person did this to me, that person didn't do this for me. You know? Therefore, I have a solid, solidified relationship with that person. What I'm suggesting is big, it's so much bigger than that, we can't even imagine. I'm suggesting there is no realness to any of your relationships. It's always shifting. You're always interpreting it in a new way. And we ask ourselves, I studied psychology in college and then worked in mental health for a long time. And you're trying to get at what's the root cause of this psychosis, you know? What's the root cause of this issue? We're undermining that model. The root cause is always fluctuating. So, I want to leave it there for a minute. And, I knew the psychologist was going to be. No, go ahead. Psychiatrist.
In this process of planting the seeds, it's like we're always kind of planting seeds. How does that relate to selfishness?
Yeah, right. That's a great question. I've had people walk out in the talk at this point, because in a sense what I'm saying is, let's use money, right? I was just in Detroit. I was doing business consultations there, which is very, if those of you that know my financial situation, it's very funny. So I was giving business consultations, and we're talking about seed planting in the business community. And if you want your company to be prosperous, if what I'm saying is true, where does money come from? It's come from seeds you planted. What kind of seeds do you have to plant?
Give it away.
Yeah, generosity. In this tradition, we're saying that money comes from generosity. There's a lot of problems with that. We see people that have money that aren't generous. We see people that are generous that don't have money. And we can address all those. But then the question comes, if I'm giving money away just to become generous, isn't that kind of selfish? Right? If I'm being generous just to get money in return, isn't there a kind of non-Christian-like, an unchristian-like nature to that? If I'm being kind to somebody because I want people to be kind to me, isn't there something like unchristian? And this is something I still struggle with a little bit, and it's... we can look at it a couple different ways. I think one way we can look at it is they say in Buddhist scripture that we have never had an altruistic thought in our whole life. That even when we think we're doing something out of kindness, there's always something in it for us. You know? So the idea that I'm giving money away because I want to be financially stable is not more Christian than any other thing we've ever done in our whole lives. It just may be more obvious, you know? But even when I'm giving charity, anonymously, they say in the Eastern tradition that there is a selfish imprint in all of those things, right? So that's the first thing. It's not so much a question between selfishness and selflessness, right? It's just a question between wisdom, doing it with wisdom. Now the second point is, if I give money to get money, first of all, if I gain some faith in this system, right? Imagine you believed completely in cause and effect. Mm-hmm. Imagine you believe completely in cause and effect. What you give is what you get. What you sow, so shall you reap. You can't get grapes from thistles. Imagine you really believed in that. What kind of person would you become?
Poor.
could you?
Yeah, my teacher, he challenges people to, with wisdom, try to become poor. Meaning that to try to give away and see if you can really become poor, you know? But what kind of person would you become if you really believed in cause and effect? Meaning, if you really believed in this notion of planting seeds, you would become a being that, because what do we all want? We all of us in this room share one thing. We want to be happy. And we want to be free of suffering. We all have that common denominator. If we gain some wisdom in how that actually works, right? If I started to realize that when I'm being divisive in my speech, it's hurting nobody but me. Right? It's hurting nobody but me. If I really started to understand that, right, I would become less divisive. And this is the very interesting thing about Buddhist morality and Buddhist ethics, is it, at first, you are not being ethical because it's a good thing to do. You're not being ethical because you're an upright citizen. You're not being ethical because your church or your community or your grandmother taught you to be ethical. You're being ethical because it's the only thing that actually works to create happiness for you. You see what I mean? The Dalai Lama calls it enlightened self-interest. You just realize what works. And you realize, well, every time I'm divisive, I'm actually, what I'm trying to do. What are you trying to do when you're divisive? I'm trying to get you to like me, and I think that you liking me involves you not liking this other person. I mean, if we just look at divisiveness, I'm divisive all the time. It's so hard. I'm like addicted to it, you know? And I walk into work, and I think like unconsciously, I'm trying to get you to not like that person, so that you and I have like this bond, you know? It's like, you know, it's like constant Survivor, that TV show where you have alliances, you know? But if we look at seed planting, what am I actually doing? I actually just planted the seeds for somebody to not like me. All the time I'm doing the opposite of what I want to be doing. I'm constantly doing the opposite of what I want to be doing. So morality becomes not so much to be a good person or so people will like you. It becomes because it's the only thing that actually works to make you happy. So it's a totally different way of thinking about morality. And you could think at first it sounds selfish, but actually when you are a happier person, what is actually happening is your heart is opening up to other people. I just ran into an old friend, and I hadn't seen him maybe in 15 years, and not that long, maybe 8 years. About 8 years, and I remembered the last time I saw him. And I remembered I was waiting tables the last time I saw him, and his father came and him came into the restaurant, and his father gave me a bad tip. Okay? Nothing like 8 years, this is what I remembered. And I'm sitting there talking to him at a cafe downtown, and I'm like, I cannot believe that that just came into my mind. You know? 8 years I've held on to this like subtle, very small grudge towards his father. Like, it's sick. I need help, right? Now, if I really believed in cause and effect, if I really believed in seed planting, where did that bad tip come from?
Yourself.
It came from seeds I planted. But let's not ask the question, is it real or isn't it not real? Let's ask the question, how does it function? If I saw that from coming from seeds from myself, would I have held on to that grudge for 8 years?
No.
It's the difference between stubbing your toe and having somebody step on your toe. If somebody steps on your toe, you're going to hold a grudge. If you stub your toe, it's over in a couple minutes. You know what I mean? The Tibetans say that being mad at people is like expressing anger to people is like eating rat poison and waiting for the rats to die. And that's what we're doing all the time, right? Every time I blame you for things that are happening to me, I'm just poisoning my own body. It's very interesting, it's very subtle. Any questions here at this point? Any complaints?
No.
No, all right.
The only thing I get, if you're not selfish, how do you exist?
If you're not selfish, how can you exist?
Yeah, because don't you perceive yourself?
Yeah, well, I don't know. That might be over my head. That's over my head. But I think it brings me to my next point. Something I want to talk about just briefly, and I think we'll just go for a little bit longer, just for another 10 minutes or so. So stay with it. I want to propose a notion of heaven and quickly show a path to get there. In the Tibetan tradition, in the Eastern traditions, and all the every yogic tradition, every Hindu tradition, they have a model of the inner body. And we're now getting more comfortable with it because we see it in things like acupuncture. Right? What does acupuncture deal with? It deals with a subtle energy that moves through the body. Which if you asked your grandfather if he believed in that, he would say it was hogwash, right? Or maybe even your parents, right? But now we're starting to have some faith in that there is something there because we see acupuncture or things like Chinese medicine actually have some efficacy. Right, word? So I want to give you a quick look at the inner body. There's a central channel that starts right here and it runs right there. It runs a little bit in front of the spine into the center of the body and it loops up in the area of the groin and ends at the tip of the sexual organ. It's called the Sushumna. We talked about this last night for those of you that were there, but the word him comes from that. That's why him is spelled with a, in that way, right? But Sushumna, it means the singing channel. In Tibetan, that's what it's called in Sanskrit. In Tibetan, it's called Uma, right? Those of you that know Professor Thurman, Robert Thurman is a great Buddhist scholar. His daughter, Uma Thurman, she's named after the central channel, right? When you have thoughts of compassion, when you have thoughts of love, when you have thoughts of kindness, you have what's called prana, this subtle energy moving through that central channel. another name for prana in Chinese medicine is called qi. Right? In Japanese, it's called ki. In Tibetan, it's called lung. In Sanskrit, it's called prana. In the native traditions, Native American traditions, it's called Arendra. They had a whole theory of the subtle body as well. So most of us only have prana running freely through the central channel two times. One at the moment of orgasm and the other at the moment of death. That's the only time in our lives where we have prana running freely through that central channel. Mostly we have it run through these two side channels. And what happens is these two side channels wrap around the central channel. like that. Now the left-hand channel is called Chandra, or it's called the Ida. And it has to do with us wanting things ignorantly. Every time we want something ignorantly, we have prana move into that left-hand channel. When I come home, and it's like 12 o'clock at night, and I know I shouldn't eat anymore, right? Because it's like past eating time. And I open the fridge, and there's like a beautiful lemon square, right? And it's sitting there, and I think, I'm not going to eat that. Right? And then this, like, anxiety comes into my body because I want the lemon square so badly, right? I'm having prana move into that left-hand channel. All this subtle energy is moving into that channel, and it's actually choking off my central channel. It's making it harder for me to have a compassion. When we're suffering from addictive behavior, right? We have blinders that go over us, and we can't even think about others, right? This is the left-hand channel. I'm going to put it on this side, so it's like as if this is the back of the body, right? We can say the Ida. It also deals with subject, which is a whole other story. But we can say wanting things. And important to say, wanting things in an ignorant way, meaning that I would be willing to hurt you to get it, or hurt myself, or not consider others to get it. It's that blinder wanting. It's not, I want you to be free of suffering. It's not that kind of wanting. It's an ignorant wanting. So on this side, what would we have? If we have wanting here, what would be the opposite? What would be the negative opposite?
Not wanting,
yeah. So anytime we don't want something, what's a negative thing that we wouldn't want?
Pain.
No, that would be a not, what would be an ignorant not wanting? To not want pain is not, it's like, yeah, that's a good thing to not want. What would be a bad thing to not want?
Well, I
want
to take care of.
Yeah, I think of like not wanting that annoying person to be near me, right? Not wanting the traffic right now. Not wanting that slow driver in front of me, right? You could also think of it as aversion. Another way to think about it is anger, irritability. Anytime we're angry, I mean, anger really has to do with not wanting something. Something is coming to you that you don't want, that you're angry about. And again, it has to do with ignorance. It doesn't mean not wanting to suffer, right? It means not wanting something in a way where I hurt somebody to get it. So anytime I have that not wanting, right, I have the prana moving into the right-hand channel of the body. And here's the interesting thing. It physically makes it harder for me to have a compassionate thought. You see what I'm saying? It physically makes it harder for me to have a compassionate thought. Another way to describe these channels is, this channel is called the Ha channel, and this is called the Tha channel. Now, yoga, right, comes from the Indo-European group, huge, Y-U-G. What does yoga mean? Union. Huge means to join two things together. A yoke comes from the same root. So, has anybody ever heard of Hatha Yoga?
No.
Right? What is Hatha Yoga? It is the joining, the union of the sun and the moon channels. The right-hand channel and the left-hand channel into the central channel. When you can move all of your negative prana out of those two side channels into the central channel, You have reached the goal of yoga. And the goal of yoga is to have prana running freely through the central channel. Now here's how I try to imagine that, right? Because what are the two times we've had that happen in our lives? At the moment of orgasm and at the moment of death. We don't really remember death, so we can't imagine what that's like, right? But we can imagine the moment of orgasm. And what I imagine, that a new model of heaven, right? A new model of, because basically what they say is when that happens, when those two side channels dissolve into the central channel, the body changes into a whole different kind of body. It changes into a body of light. And we're talking angels now, right? Which most of us, I would say most of us don't really believe in angels, really. It's maybe something that happened, I don't know about you, but I think commonly, angels were something that existed long ago. And, you know, they have these wings, and now they're these, you know, maybe slightly, like, weird stained glass things we put on our window, you know, over the kitchen sink, and there's, like, angel. But this is a whole different notion, that when you can actually take those two side channels and move it into the central channel, the body physically starts to transform. Because this is no different than the podium. The arm itself is just coming from seed that I've planted. What are the seeds that I've seen myself in this body that has to die? You know? They're seeds of self-cherishing. When I can begin to, like, they call it samsara. It's kind of like a cyclical existence because I'm always planting seeds of self-cherishing. If I can begin to reverse that order, right, and I can start to plant these seeds of kindness and compassion, deep, deep, deep compassion, then I can start to actually transform that, move more prana out of these two side channels, more prana into the central channel. Now when I have more prana in the central channel, I'm actually making it physically easier for me to be compassionate. It's why try going to a yoga class, and try going to a yoga class irritable, and see how you feel when you get out of the yoga class. It's not some mystery, you know. It's because you're actually, when I turn to the left, I'm loosening that right-hand channel, and I'm making it harder for me to be irritable. When I turn to the right, you know, I'm actually loosening the left-hand channel. I'm making it harder for me to engage in addictive behavior. It's very fascinating. So when the prana moves into that central channel, again, we only have the model of orgasm to go on. But I think about a time that I was able to save a goat that I was canoeing in the Rio Grande. And I passed by it, and it was ba, and I looked over, and it just its mouth was sticking out of the mud. It had been sinking, and its eyes were even under. It must have felt like the water or something, because it started to call out, right? And me and my buddies were able to go up, and we were able to, like, over an hour or so, pull this goat, dig it up out of the muck. And we fed it, like, our power bars, you know, we made a mush with water and power bars, and we fed it. And eventually it came back to life and it walked away, right? That experience of finding somebody who's in desperate need and having everything they need to help them. It's an incredible feeling, right? It's maybe the most amazing feeling we've ever experienced. It's maybe the most beautiful experience we've ever experienced to find somebody who really is in need, a life or death threatening situation, and you have the power to help them. Because mostly what we experience is people in that situation all the time on the news and stuff, and we feel disempowered. We can't help them. And it creates a kind of deep grief. But I imagine when we get prana to the central channel, it's a mixture of the moment of orgasm mixed with that incredible feeling of deeply, deeply serving people. Really able to care about people in the deepest possible way, right? Actually being able to save, you know, somebody's life like that. Just imagine that sensation, right? Suddenly, when I put those two in a meditation, when I really try to imagine what those two together are like, heaven doesn't sound so vampiric. You know what I mean? It doesn't sound like I'm just walking around in the same mind, like, in, you know, eternity. And also, when you move those two side channels into the central channel, subject and object also dissolve. So it's a sense of time that we can't even comprehend. But what I can imagine, there's some exquisite beauty that I can only get close to imagining, right? And that's why I often think about Jesus is always holding out an invitation. When I think about, like, you know, in Sunday school, it's always like, you need to be a better person. You know, you should do this and you shouldn't do that. And as I get older and my life gets more complex and, like, I've got taxes to do, you know, and, like, I'm overwhelmed by life. The last thing I need is more to-dos, you know? And for me, it doesn't work. A spiritual life of to-dos doesn't work. I have no willpower. I ate the lemon bar. You know, I did. Because the tension of not eating it became so great that I had to eat it just to resolve that tension. And the more the tension between the not eating, the more that grows, the more pleasure comes from eating.
You feel better.
It's fascinating, right? The more the tension of trying to resist, the greater the elusive sense of pleasure comes when that tension is. So that spiritual life, that spiritual model does not work for me because I have no willpower, right? I'm a pleasure seeker. But when I can shift it and suddenly realize that Jesus is holding out an invitation to enter a kingdom which is so much greater than this kingdom. You see what I mean? In a sense, it's not so much trying to figure out how to be a better person, but how to imagine a deeper sense of reality. How to imagine a more beautiful sense of reality. The play becomes about how to visualize a deeper pleasure than I can visualize now. A pleasure that involves not only the highest physical pleasure I can imagine, but also the highest emotional pleasure, which is always, when you look at it in your life over and over and over again, it's always in service of somebody else. When you're really the most happiest, it's always somehow in service of others. And, you know, Jesus says, narrow is the gate which leads to everlasting life, and wide open is the gate which leads to death and destruction, right? It's a counterintuitive path. Because I think to make myself the happiest, I should go after things that make me happy. But really, what all the spiritual traditions are saying is to be the happiest, I should try to make you happy. To be the happiest involves serving you in some way. So, that's a lot, and we just recovered two of my four pages that I was going to present.